Hey, welcome to the Joe Scarborough podcast. It's so great to have you here with us. I'm very excited. I've got some guys that were musical heroes of mine for a very long time. REM's founding members, Michael Stipe and Mike Mills are here, and they're here to celebrate the 25th anniversary of New Adventures in Hi-Fi. And let's bring them in right now. What I loved about this album is that you guys, even when you did sound checks, instead of just sort of going through the songs, painting by numbers, you were writing songs during the sound checks. That had to make that tour special for you.
Well, they were writing songs during the sound check. I was in my dressing room preparing for the live show that night. And when Mike speaks about the energy of the road, yeah, that's deeply infused into the music and into the track. But the most boring thing on earth is a band that thinks that they're important enough to make the narrative slant or arc of their lyric and their stories that they're telling about themselves, and particularly about being a touring band. So none of the songs, with the exception of Departure, are particularly about us. I mean, I'm not an autobiographic writer to start with. This record has the distinction of having two really, really great songs on it that are actually somewhat autobiographic. Departure is one of them. Ebo the Letter is the other. And I think both of those came from experiences that I had that were very, very close and very, for me, very emotional. And they were good enough that I kind of broke my own rules and allowed them to be on this record.
Well, can you talk about Ebo the Letter? Because it's, first of all, what a thrill to be able to play with Patti Smith. But also, could you explain to people about finding that letter and actually grabbing it and saying, wait a second, we can put this into a song, and talk about how that developed?
It was because of Patti Smith that we became a band in 1979, because of her work as a singer-songwriter and as a performer. And so we owed her a great debt, and we had the opportunity to meet her on the road in 1995. We were already successful. She knew us through MTV. She and her husband would watch REM, and I was very flattered when I found that out. But the opportunity arose to have her sing on the song, and it just seemed like really fitting. So she flew out to Seattle, rather, and joined us in the studio and listened to the song and came up with this part on the spot and did what she does best.
So Mike, Michael talked earlier about Departure, and one of the things that blew me away when I first heard REM was just how original you were. I remember when I heard it in my Tuscaloosa apartment in '83, it was just like the clouds opened up, and I'm like, my God, where did this come from? But there were a couple of songs on this album where Departure was one of them, and also the Wake Up Bomb, sort of a throwback to almost Lou Reed, and I think Michael said this, early Mott the Hoople. And it was really cool hearing you guys go in that direction. What was the inspiration for that?
You know, when you sit down to write songs, you can have all the direction and purpose you want, but you don't really know what kind of song is going to come out. If you go back to Automatic for the People, we were going to try to make that a rock record, and it ended up being this really quiet, sad, introspective record. We didn't intend that at all. Monster, we did intend to be a really brash, loud record, and it worked out that way. New Adventures, we had no idea what it was going to be like. You're making a record under ever-shifting circumstances. You're writing songs on the road with no real clear idea of what you're writing about. And so it just becomes whatever it's going to become, and you really have less control over that than you might think or want to have.
Yeah. You know, when Mike, I saw your documentary on the album, you all had a consensus favorite, and it was How the West Was Won and Where It Got Us. I think at the time that everybody listed that as their favorite, you all said in part it was because you've been playing all the other songs nonstop on the road, and that one was newer for you. I'm wondering, 25 years later, is that still your favorite on the album, or do you have another song that has, through the years, that's really become more meaningful to you?
That's actually probably still my favorite because of how it came about. Bill and I were sitting in the studio, and he started playing that pattern on the drums. I literally played that piano part. I wrote it in the time it takes to play it. one of the great unnoticed things about, or under noticed things about that song is Michael played a little one note Casio part in the verses that totally changes the song. It when Michael changes the two notes he plays, it makes it sound like completely different guitar chords, and it's not. It's the same chord. It's the most subtle yet effective thing that basically that we ever did on a record in terms of how little it was and how big a difference it made. And I don't know if I ever told you that, Michael, but it's really, it was really my favorite thing about that record. And then the piano solo, if you will, is basically, I said, I'm going to play this one time. I'm not an improvisational piano player. I have no idea what this is going to sound like, but whatever it is, we're going to keep it. And it came out, you know, like basically it sounds to me like we found this guy on the street, dragged him in there and said, okay, bang on this piano until something comes out. So, and because of that weirdness, that's why I really like it. So I just think the whole fact that that song came together in the studio the way it did in almost a completely random fashion is the reason I like it so much.
So I have a quote that Mark Blackwell said about it. He said, New Adventures takes you on a sprawling, twisted journey through dark landscapes and dream states. It immerses you in oceans. It's frequently disorienting, traveling carnival in hurricane season. It's full of car crashes, damaged souls, doomed relationships, death. It's character-driven. It's cinematic. He goes on and on. Michael, this is what you said about it. The album is about despair, hopelessness, and death. Explain that one, Michael.
I'm sure there's a little bit of tongue in cheek when I gave that quote. Obviously, the themes are a little broader than that, Joe.
All right, Mike and Michael, thanks so much. Stick around. We'll be right back. You know, I've spent a lot of time lately trying to figure out how to live as healthy a life as possible. I'm getting up there in years, and I don't have the discipline, I'll be really honest with you, of Mika, who my wife can go out, she can run 6, 7, 8 miles a day. That doesn't work for me. I'll tell you what else doesn't work for me. Restrictions. I can't have a set of do's and don'ts. And so what I've found that's really helped an awful lot has been changing my relationship to food. And that's exactly what Noom does. It uses a cognitive behavioral approach. And that's something that Mika and I know an awful lot about because we've been doing that with our family for a long time now. And when you do that with Noom, you'll focus on the why instead of the what to change your relationship to eating. And here's the great thing also about Noom. Your journey is going to be different than my journey. It's going to be different than anybody else's journey. So guess what? Noom will customize a program that's based on you for your personal goals. So sign up for your trial and get psychology-based support and motivation to help you reach those goals that have been so hard to reach in the past. And you can do that by signing up at Noom.com. That's Noom.com/Scarborough. That's Noom, Noom.com/Scarborough. You'll really be glad you did. So, Michael, I want to talk to you about music and politics. You know what I thought was so cool also about you guys is you not only got involved on the national stage, you got involved locally. You got involved in Athens politics. You got involved with things around you. Michael, talk about that. I was talking, interviewed David Byrne, who was talking about the importance of focusing on local elections. And he would tell his audiences, get out and vote in local races, because only about 2 out of 10 people do that. And it makes a huge difference in your life.
Well, I'm a Democrat only so I can vote in primaries. I'm not a Democrat at all. I'm way left of that. But yeah, it's important that we recognize the way the country is set up and the way that things work, that just voting for president every 4 years, if that's what you choose to do, is not really quite enough. We need more representation in Congress, in the Senate, and in the House of Representatives. And then we need more representation on a local level. And you'd have to really have a box on your head to not be able to recognize what's happening in your own community. A lot of people don't, like you and we have the fortune to be able to go to a variety of different news sources and form our opinions. A lot of people work too hard for that, or they have families that they're raising. They don't have the ability to go to more or spend more than 30 minutes figuring out what's going on locally or internationally or nationally. And so our job as artists is really to kind of help present these ideas through the work that we do, and just be human about it. You know, we don't have to agree on everything. That's not terribly interesting. We can disagree and maybe not be cordial about it, but we can at least accept that we disagree about certain things. But the importance of being active locally is profoundly important, especially in a country the size of America.
Now, you talk about news sources, Michael. A couple of years ago, you got off Instagram. I think it's fascinating. 3 years later, everybody's talking about Instagram, the fact that it drives depression, suicide, or at least suicidal ideations, especially in teenage girls, but also causes a range of other emotional problems for Americans. You look at what Facebook's been doing. You look at the fact that they propagate propaganda, allowed not only propaganda coming from outside countries, but also a propaganda about vaccines, propaganda about COVID, propaganda about all the things that I think most rational people are concerned about. And I'm just wondering what you saw back in 2018 that caused you that much concern. And if you don't feel like you weren't more than one or two steps ahead of everybody else.
Well, the people, Joe, that set these platforms up started out kind of heroic and as people that were visionary and had an eye to the future of how, through this new technology, we're able to communicate and know everything. And they turned out to be the robber barons of the digital age. A lot of them are not good people. And we're not just talking about the figureheads, but the fish rots from the head. So I look at Twitter, I look at Facebook, I look at Instagram bought by Facebook, I look at Google, in fact, which we're speaking on right now, and I'm concerned about a lot of the kind of behind the scenes aspects of what they're presenting through these platforms that are free to us, but by hitting allow, we're allowing them into our lives in a way that I don't think most people would be terribly comfortable with. And so as a public figure, as an activist, I'm not interested in participating. It leaves me a little bit in the dust of where we are right now. And I am actually writing about that in the work that I'm doing now. But what's the guy's name? Jaron Lanier wrote the book, 10 Reasons to Stop Your, to Get Off Social Media Now. I read that and I acknowledge and recognize that I felt exactly the same way as he did about this. It's a cancer.
Right, and they are the robber barons of our age. They run monopolies, and they don't pay taxes. They certainly don't pay taxes at a rate that people that do clerical work for them or clean their offices pay. It's just extraordinary. Let me ask you, Mike. I know we're running short on time. I just want to ask you a couple of questions as a massive fan of REM, since I have this opportunity. First of all, you know, I talk to older people and they talk about where they were when they saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, or where they were the first time they heard Jimi Hendrix, or, you know, I always loved the story of Brian Wilson driving down the road and heard the Ronettes' Be My Baby, and it blew his mind so much musically he had to swerve off the road and he just stared at the radio. Again, that moment for me was in 1983 when I heard Murmur. And I remember hearing Radio Free Europe, and then I remember hearing Sitting Still, and I remember just asking myself, who the hell are these guys, and why haven't I heard of them before? And so, without sounding like Chris Farley interviewing Paul McCartney, I won't ask you if you remember that, but I will ask, how did you get from Chronic Town to Murmur? It seems to me like such a massive artistic jump. Could you just, for REM fans, could you talk about that process?
Well, quite simply, for Peter and Bill and I, and you know, Michael on the lyrical side, but for the three of us on the musical side, songwriting is the most important thing a band can do. It's the hardest thing. You know, you can teach yourself to play guitar or piano. You can teach yourself to sing. You may not be gifted with the voice that some people are, but you can teach yourself to do these things. The hard thing to do is to write songs, to write more than one or two good songs. And so that is what we focused on from the very beginning. And it was really rewarding for us to see our songwriting progress from some of the early, really simplistic stuff that we wrote, which we were happy with and was great. But to see that evolve into, you know, Gardening at Night, we always said was the first real song we wrote. When we wrote Sitting Still and Radio Free Europe, we knew that we had made a quantum leap into a whole nother level of songwriting. And when we saw that we had that and we could do that, we knew that we were on the right path in that creative sense. So that was something we focused on from the very beginning. And it turned out we were all pretty good at it. And we fed off each other very well. Peter and I especially would work as John Lennon and Paul McCartney did in the Beatles stuff. One of us would have a verse, the other would do the chorus, or one would do what they call the middle eight, what we call the bridge. It was just a really a fun thing to see that we complemented each other and fed off each other and were able to create together these beautiful little pieces of art.
And could you also talk about probably my favorite REM album, Fables? There's such a mood to that. It doesn't matter where I am. I can turn it on. I can put on the headphones. It just takes me someplace that no other music takes me. And again, it's a band that's developing. It's a band that it seems that you all were expanding what you were writing, working more with sort of the sounds and sort of the environment of the music. Talk about Fables and your jump from Reckoning to that album.
Well, the one thing about Fables is we were all actually pretty much half insane when we made that record. We had been on the road for, you know, 5 years. We were in London in the wintertime, and it was cold and wet, and everybody drove on the wrong side of the road, and there was nothing to eat, and we were just completely wacko when we made that record. We were working in a studio that was bitterly cold and damp, and it was so, everything was so quintessentially British at that point, which we were unfamiliar with. So we had that environment, and we had that atmosphere, and together with everything that was going on with us internally, we created this incredibly moody and very sound-specific record. Joe Boyd did an amazing job working with us as Looney Tunes as we were at the time. And we created this record that is bizarre. It's strange. It was made by really whacked-out people. And it holds together in a really unusual fashion. And somehow it spoke to people. I'm not sure how, but I'm glad it did.
It really did. So Michael, for kids watching, the key to doing great music, great art, is to be wacko, miserable, and cold, right?
Well, to add to what Mike was saying, I mean, this is before catalytic converters, so all of London smelled like you had your head up a muffler, and I had a headache the whole time, and I couldn't sing right because my throat hurt. I decided, Mike, do you remember that it'd be a really good time during the recording of that record for me to do a 21-day fast, so I ate nothing but brown rice and drank coffee, which really added to my already burgeoning nervous breakdown that went on for the next year and a half. But Joe, as a fan, I will say that Fables is where I found my voice as a lyricist. And I felt the confidence of being able to write a narrative story to help populate the vista that I see when I hear music. When I hear great music, like what Mike, Peter, and Bill presented to me with the music that they offered me, I see a landscape. And so I was able to, through Fables, I had the confidence to actually do something more than just sing kind of nonsense. And I, as much as I love the earlier albums, I was taking a lot from William Burroughs and Brian Gysin and the idea of cut-up to present my part of those records. I was really using my voice as an instrument.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot of meaning behind it that goes beyond the emotional. But with Fables, I was actually writing stories about characters, creating those characters, some of whom were drawn from life, others of whom I made up. And I it's when I moved from being a writer who basically was looking around and using a more autobiographic or a more single person perspective to being a writer who created and invented things. And you hear that in the music. I do love that record, I have to say.
Yeah, you certainly do hear it in the music. It's just an extraordinary work all these years later. It not only holds up, but like all these albums and all the music, it's actually better.
By the way, I'd love to add that your activism and your voice on your show, I've been watching for a really long time. And I, as an activist, I appreciate the positions that you guys have taken of late. And I want to applaud you for that. I really mean that sincerely.
Well, that means the world to me. I must tell you, during the age of Trump, after about 2 or 3 years in, I would wake up and I would tell Mika, I can't do this anymore. I feel like I am a seal barking at waves. I can't do this anymore. It's not making any difference. And Mika would say, get the hell up and get in front of the camera and start talking. So you telling me that means an awful lot. It really does. These are such perilous times for this country, and we're still in the middle of it all. And I'm sure you're not a Douglas MacArthur fan, but I will quote Douglas MacArthur: in this battle for liberal democracy, there's no substitute for victory. There is no other option. But for the forces of liberalism, democracy, free press, it's a battle that we all have to win. And I will tell you, one of the things that I have been heartened by, Mike, because I remember standing next to you, even in my Republican days, standing next to you and talking to you during a Tibet Freedom concert rally on the Capitol steps. One of the things that has been heartening is being able to stand side by side with people who I haven't been standing side by side politically throughout my life. And seeing that when the test came, which friends of mine through the years fell off and fell to the side and showed how little they cared about the Constitution and checks and balances and how shallow their words were. And people who I'd been battling with my entire life, I found out that they loved this country, they loved this Constitution, they loved what made this melting pot what it was, every bit as much as myself or anybody else. And that actually has been a real awakening for me.
That's hopefully it's been an awakening for a lot of people, Joe, because the battle that we're fighting right now is much more than the battle between left and right, between conservative and liberal. The battle lines are much deeper than that. We are actually literally fighting for the life and strength of our democracy. And there are people that are doing their best to undermine that for their own purposes. And the only way to defeat that is going to take people from both sides coming together to realize that you know, your positions on one side of an issue or another are not the real problem we have right now. The real problem is people who are just who don't care about anything except self gain and self promotion and maintaining power. And it's going to take all of us, I think, to stop that from destroying what we have.
I agree. Thank you guys so much for being here today. Thank you for talking not only about New Adventures in Hi-Fi, but also your other works and where we are as a country. And Michael, I look forward to having you back to talk about your book, photography. And anytime you want to come on, Mike, and talk about the Baseball Project Band, you are more than welcome. A lot of baseball fans, as you know, on Morning Joe.
That's fact. And thank you, Joe. I appreciate that. I look forward to it.
Thanks a lot, Joe. Great to talk to you.
Thanks so much for being with us. Michael Stipe and Mike Mills, it's been great having you on to celebrate the 25th anniversary of New Adventures in Hi-Fi. And we thank you for listening to the Joe Scarborough Podcast. We'll talk to you soon.
Five new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.